Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Russian Orthodox Church elects a new patriarch. Hear more about this first election since the fall of the Soviet Union and what it may mean for relations with the Catholic Church. And a small territory with a great mission. The Vatican City State gears up for a program of events to celebrate its 80th birthday. A small territory for a great mission. That was how Pope Pius XI described Vatican City State when it was founded on February 11, 1929, with the signing of the Lateran Pact. And it's also the title for a programme of celebratory events, marking the 80th anniversary of the smallest state in the world. Just 44 hectares that surround the papal apartments, the headquarters of the Swiss Guards, the famous Vatican museums, and the bank, shops and offices that enable the church to carry out its worldwide spiritual mission. The celebrations for this 80th anniversary include an exhibition, which opens on February the 12th, a concert and a three-day conference, which begins on that same day, plus a special commemorative coin and Vatican stamp collection. The man in charge of the day-to-day management of Vatican City State is Italian Bishop Renato Boccardo, Secretary General of the state's governing body. I went up to his office to find out more about the forthcoming events and the history that led up to the founding of this unique sovereign state.
First of all, we will have the original document of the Trattato del Laterano, which is the agreement between Italy and the Holy See about the daily life, if you can say, of the Catholic Church here in Rome. Pope Pius XI wanted to have a small territory where the Holy See could live and work. So he worked a lot with the Italian government to find the solution to the Questione Romana, which is the presence of the Italian army in the territories belonging to the Holy See. And in 1929, the 11th of February, the two delegates, Cardinal Pietro Gasparri, the Secretary of State, and Mr. Benito Mussolini, the head of the Italian government, signed the agreement between the two parts. So we will expose in our exhibition the original document, which is kept in the Vatican archives, and I think nobody saw after that time. We will have a special car, the Citroën, given to the Pope Pius XI, will be in the exhibition, so people can see what kind of special car they gave to the Pope, and different maps of the territory, because during 3 years, the two commissions worked to find the right territory for the Holy See. So people will see all this process, preparing the Trattato del Laterano and the new situation for the Pope and the Roman Curia.
It was a time of great tension, wasn't it, between the Vatican and the newly founded state of Italy. How can we describe that relationship or the development of that relationship perhaps over the decades?
Well, we have to know that in 1870, the Italian government took all the territories in central Italy, where the power of the Pope was working and staying. After that time, the Pope stayed only in the Vatican, and he was like a prisoner. So during 50 years and more, they were very difficult moment between the Italian government and the Vatican. Little by little, in both sides, they understood that something we have to do something. So the Pope Benedict the 15th started to have some informal contacts with the Italian government, and finally Pius the 11th worked hard to find a solution. After that time, after the we call it the conciliazione, 1929, of course the cooperation, the mutual cooperation and understanding between Italy and the Holy See was growing. And we can say that today we can work together for the common good of people.
There are those who would question today the need for an independent sovereign state in order to exercise the spiritual authority of the Pope. How do you answer that?
The Pope Pius XI wanted to have a small territory, a symbolic territory, he said, because he thought that the Holy See need to have independence, freedom, to serve the gospel and humanity. So our territory, only 44 hectares, is very small and is symbolic, but it gives to the Holy See the right situation to have and to serve the gospel and humanity in freedom and sovereignty.
It's a fascinating place. Many people are very curious about what goes on behind the walls of the Vatican. Are you trying somehow to change that image today, to throw open the doors with your new website and so on?
Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the Vatican is the house of the Pope, so of the father of all Catholics. And we have museums. In the museums you can have centuries and centuries of art, histories, and it's open to everybody. We have the Basilica, the St. Peter's Square and the St. Peter's Basilica. And we have, since 2 years now, we have a website where we try to open the doors and to keep in contact with people all around the world. I think during the first 6 months of our website, we have 14 million of visitors. So it means that people are interested in the Vatican, and for our side, our will to open and to be in contact with everybody.
The Vatican is also famous for its stamps and its coin collections. You have a special edition, a commemorative edition for this 80th anniversary, don't you?
Yes, we have. It will be presented on the 10th of February. We'll have 5 stamps with each one of the popes from 1929 until today, until Pope Benedict the 16th. And we will have, at the end of the year, I think in October, a special coin of €2 to commemorate this anniversary.
The figure of Pope Pius XI, as you say, is key to this anniversary celebration, and there's a lot of material about him and in the exhibition, isn't there? Including, again, some unpublished pictures, I understand.
Yes, he is the founder of the Vatican State. He was a very strong man. He wanted to give the new organization to the newborn state, and his presence is still alive here in the Vatican, because many buildings, many monuments, he wanted to have, he personally was following all the details for the construction for the buildings.
And my thanks there to Bishop Renato Boccardo, Secretary General of the Governing Body of Vatican City State. And we'll be bringing you more news of those anniversary events over the coming days, but you can also find information on the website www.vaticanstate.va. The Russian Orthodox Church this week elected a new leader. The 62-year-old Metropolitan Kirill, who's well known outside his native country, having served for many years as head of the church's foreign relations department. In a personal telegram, Pope Benedict sent his warmest greetings to the new patriarch, congratulating him and asking God, quote, to bless your efforts to maintain communion among the Orthodox churches and to seek that fullness of communion, which is the goal of Catholic Orthodox collaboration and dialogue. Metropolitan Kirill had been serving as interim head of the church since the death in December of Patriarch Alexei II. On Tuesday, he won over 500 of the 677 votes cast in a secret ballot by the Council of Electors, which includes both religious and laity from Russia and the diaspora. At the weekend, he will be formally installed as the new head of Russian Orthodoxy, by far the largest church in the Orthodox world. Leading a delegation from the Vatican to that event will be Cardinal Walter Kasper, head of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. He told me that despite differences of opinion and past difficulties, he has high hopes for the progress of ecumenical dialogue under the new patriarch.
Yes, first I want to say we are pleased about this election. He's elected with a very large majority. It seems that the Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Church is united around him, and of course we know him since many years, and I met him in different occasions. I think he's a man of dialogue. He has strong convictions, strong positions, and he expressed it also before his elections. We have to recognize his positions, but on the other hand, we can have dialogue with him, and we are willing to continue the dialogue, first of all about the social and cultural problems, which are very important for the future of Europe. We have to strengthen the Christian values, and here the Russian Orthodox Church, the Catholic Church, and all the other churches have to work together. But that's not all. The ecumenical movement has a goal which is beyond this cultural and social dimension. It's a commandment of our Lord that all be one. So the final goal is full communion in faith, sacraments, and apostolic ministry of the churches. That theological part is discussed in the mixed commission between the Catholic Church and all Orthodox churches. We hope that the Russian Orthodox Church is able to return on the table of the dialogue. I did a lot on both sides to facilitate this return. And so we want to go on with him. But I think this election is also a new phase for the Russian Orthodox Church. It was a very great merit of the late Patriarch Alexei II to rebuild his church after a terrible period of oppression and persecution. And it is a real rebirth of the Russian Orthodox Church. But as the late Patriarch told me in my last meeting with him, it was in May last year, that it's not enough to rebuild the walls of the church. We have to rebuild the spirituality of our church. And this is a program which the new patriarch announced already, the spiritual, the catechetical renewal of its church. And if we can, we are ready to help him in this regard. We have some experience in this field. And so it's a mutual cooperation between the churches.
Cardinal Kasper, what does the election of Metropolitan Kirill mean in terms of the possibility of a papal visit to Moscow, to Russia?
Well, I'm always asked whether the new patriarch will meet the Holy Father. He met him as Metropolitan already 3 times immediately after his election, and then 2 times in 2006 and 2007. But now we think he needs time to be settled in his new ministry, and so we do not want to push him and to leave time, to have patience for such a meeting, which we want, which would be a great advantage, but we have to respect also the arguments of the other side. So we pray for him that God may bless him with all the gifts which are necessary to guide such a big and such an important church as the Russian Orthodox Church is.
You mentioned the difficulties within the Orthodox world. Do you think that the new Patriarch may be able to perhaps put those problems behind him and forge a stronger role for Moscow within the Orthodox world?
Well, there are problems within the Orthodox world, which is obvious. We normally do not interfere, we do not enter in these problems, but we can do to admonish, to help to both or to all sides to come together, because we are for Christian unity, and this means to be also for unity among our partners. This is a part of it, and so we hope that he is able to overcome some tensions which appeared in the past.
Cardinal Walter Kasper there, President of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity. Despite his optimistic assessment, many observers say progress towards Christian unity is unlikely to be high on the agenda of the new Russian Orthodox leader, though he may prove to be a much more outspoken figure than his predecessor, Alexei II.
The majority of the Orthodox Church in Russia really has no interest in ecumenism.
Geraldine Fagan is a religious affairs analyst and Moscow correspondent with Forum 18, a news agency which monitors religious rights and freedoms in the former Soviet Union. I talked to her about the new Patriarch and the way in which his election has been received by people on the streets there in the Russian capital.
Well, there certainly doesn't seem to have been as much interest or as a response as to the death of the late Patriarch, Alexei II, when there were quite a few scenes, I think, of public outpouring of grief and general feeling of loss. But certainly when the results were announced of the election, the main Russian television channels interrupted their broadcasting to report what had happened. And so it's certainly been considered a major event, obviously, because it's the first post-Soviet election of a Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
And has there been official reactions from government officials?
A little, yes. So far, the president, Dmitry Medvedev, has telephoned the new Patriarch Kirill and congratulated him on his election and expressed hope that dialogue between the church and the state will continue. And I've heard that Prime Minister Putin has also telephoned him to congratulate him, but there's very little other than that so far.
It hasn't always been an easy relationship, has it, in the years since the end of the Soviet regime? I mean, what do you see as the challenges in this particular field of church-state relations?
Yes, particularly with the new Patriarch Kirill, the situation, the general situation between the church and state might get trickier, because certainly Alexei, the last patriarch, was generally seen as a very diplomatic figure, quite accommodating to the state, and generally quite ready to go with the flow in most cases, with a few exceptions. He really didn't speak out against any of the government's policies. But Kirill is somewhat different, a figure. He's highly intelligent. He's had a lot of experience in international affairs. And he's very active in formulating his own or the church's own policies and standpoints on a number of issues, including human rights. So, in fact, he wasn't the Kremlin's preferred candidate. And I think they'll be a little bit cautious in the government now, and will wait to see, once he's patriarch, if he's going to now take more of a back seat and settle into the kind of role that Patriarch Alexei played, or whether he'll continue with his more political activities and perhaps be more likely to challenge the state in some areas.
So we may see the church, in fact, taking a slightly more prominent position or a louder voice, perhaps, in public affairs, in the running of the country.
I think so, yes. I mean, that's certainly going to be the case in comparison with Patriarch Alexei II. It's just a question of how far Kirill will go. That really isn't clear yet.
Kirill also seems to be a popular figure at sort of grassroots level. I was looking at polls earlier in the week saying he was
pointed to as the most popular person to take over from Alexei. I mean, what can you tell me about his popular leadership, if you like?
Well, I mean, he's certainly popular among, I mean, this has been shown by the vote in which he got, I think, more than 500 votes out of 700. So that shows that he's obviously the most popular candidate by far. But I think a lot of that popularity rests upon his obvious skills as a leader. I mean, there is really no one at that level who's proven himself to be such a good manager, orator, diplomat. He's got so many skills in that way that I think that's really been the clinching factor for his election. Among the faithful, and I think at a grassroots level, he isn't actually particularly popular. There's some real doubts about him because of his perceived associations with the ecumenical movement. And in fact, prior to his election, he was very energetic in trying to distance himself from any ecumenical positions and reassure particularly the major monastic centres that he wasn't going to sell the Russian Orthodox Church out in any way or compromise its position with any other Christian tradition. So there really are some doubts about his ecumenical credentials.
And yet he's a very well-known figure to leaders of other churches because he's been in charge of external relations. But where do you think then he may be trying to lead the ecumenical movement if the grassroots is simply not ready to follow him on a path towards reconciliation?
Well, I think what he will do, I mean, he will probably continue the course that he's been promoting so far, which is really to maintain certainly involvement, the church's involvement in dialogue with other churches abroad, but without actually, I would say, giving away any concessions or any ground on anything of substance. So, for instance, it was his department which continued to allege that the Catholic Church was involved in proselytism in Russia and poaching converts in West Ukraine. At the same time, it was that department would send representatives to international conferences and meetings in Europe on ecumenical issues. So I think he'll continue that kind of double-edged kind of position.
But you're saying we're unlikely to see any real substantial progress, no chance, for example, of a meeting between Pope Benedict, perhaps, and the new patriarch, even if that was not to be in Moscow. You don't think it's very likely at the moment?
I don't think any meeting would be likely soon. I certainly don't think, precisely because he has to keep these conservative elements views in consideration, I certainly don't think there would be a chance of a visit to Russia by Pope Benedict. But I think it's very possible at some point that he might be prepared to meet in a purely symbolic way, to meet Pope Benedict somewhere outside Russia. I think that's probably more likely than with the last patriarch.
What do you think is the main element that is continuing to keep this conservative faction that you're talking about so very much against any real substantial progress in ecumenical relations?
Well, basically, the majority of the Orthodox Church in Russia really has no interest in ecumenism. It's not necessarily a hostile position. It's more, I would say, one of indifference, in fact. Most Orthodox here are basically sure that the Orthodox Church is the sole Church of Christ, and there's really no need to adopt anything from outside or to adapt Orthodoxy or change it in favor of any other Christian tradition. So that is really where the lack of interest and involvement in ecumenism is coming from.
And yet the Orthodox churches, like the other churches, are facing huge threats from secularism, a loss of numbers of people interested in going to church at all. This surely is going to, in the end, push them towards a realization of the need for perhaps closer cooperation in many areas.
I think they would look at cooperation, certainly in, like, say, the social spheres, quite differently. And I would think at some point, probably yes, that they would be prepared to cooperate with anybody really in the social sphere. But as far as theology goes, really, I don't see even a lack of or a drop in involvement in Orthodox life on the part of the Russian people. Really, I don't think that would push the Orthodox Church in the direction of other churches. I think it would maintain its position, really, no matter how popular it was at home.
So Pope John Paul's appeal some years ago, asking other church leaders to help him find a way in which perhaps the primacy of Peter could be seen and accepted by other churches, at the moment this is likely to be falling on deaf ears still.
Definitely, yes, and I think it will be for a long time to come.
A little bit about the other candidates. There were three names on the list for this leadership position of Patriarch. Can you tell us a little bit about the other two candidates, Metropolitan Filaret and Metropolitan Clement?
Metropolitan Filaret is a little older than Kirill, and he's currently Metropolitan in Minsk in Belarus. And he, as far as I understand, he does suffer from health problems. And he's really, again, I mean, all the candidates really are from the same Soviet-era stable. But Metropolitan Filaret really is not that different in his general outlook from Kirill, but he just simply doesn't have the dynamism. And I think the church is generally pretty happy with him as he is in Belarus. So I would expect that a combination of those factors basically contributed in him deciding to pull out of the race at the last minute. Metropolitan Clement, he's the bishop in a Russian town called Kaluga, and he was generally believed to be the Kremlin's preferred candidate, somebody slightly more in the mould of Patriarch Alexei II, more pliable. He was elected to, or appointed by Putin, to the public chamber in Moscow when it was set up a few years ago, when he was, in fact, the only Russian Orthodox bishop to be directly appointed by Putin to that body. And so people obviously interpreted that as a sign that he was the favoured successor to Patriarch Alexei. But really, in the end, there just simply wasn't enough known about him or enough ground support for him to be a credible alternative to Kirill.
And my thanks there to Geraldine Fagan, Moscow correspondent with Forum 18, a news agency which monitors religious rights and freedoms in the former Soviet Union. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.